Well, could so-called hidden homes be the fast, low-impact solution to New Zealand's housing crisis that is so desperately needed? A new report's found that at least 180,000 extra homes could be created on existing residential properties by partitioning houses or adding extra units on site. It estimates 12% of New Zealand's housing stock could be partitioned, enabling more homes without impinging on greenfield sites or vacant residential land. But the report says complicated and inconsistent council rules mean so-called additional dwelling units, or ADUs, are a missed opportunity. The ADU potential report, done as one of the national science challenges, suggests that the Auckland region alone has a potential 45,000 homes that could be partitioned. Also, as new units on existing properties could be prefabricated, they could be quickly developed. Kay Saville-Smith is the director of CRESA, the Centre for Research Evaluation and Social Assessment. She says up till now, the housing crisis has been talked about largely in terms of constraints on mortgage finance and arguments over land supply and land prices. But there is an underutilised housing resource right under our noses. Kay, good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
This is for a national science challenge. What were you asked to do?
Well, the Better Building Homes, Towns and Cities challenge has been asked by government to look at the ways that we can improve our cities, our towns and our homes. And it actually was the people's choice. When government was talking about national science challenges, they went out and consulted. There were 10 challenges came up, first of all. But everyone pointed out that our cities and homes are our big problem for the future. So the government then funded that. And that looks as though it will continue. This is a big issue for New Zealand. It's a big issue for our productivity. It's a big issue for our lifestyle and our life chances.
How did you go about getting the numbers that you've got here?
Well, this particular bit comes out of a strategic research area, we call it, in the Better Building Homes, Towns and Cities, called the Architecture of Decision Making. And one of the things that we were really interested in is what are the resources that we have in New Zealand to actually meet our supply needs for housing. So instead of just looking at the land and the finance, which we're doing anyhow, we then went back to the census and said, how many dwellings have we got that are underutilised? And unlike some underutilisation calculations, we took a very conservative approach. Instead of saying, well, if you're a couple, you can share one bedroom and if there's an extra bedroom, you can divide that home up. We said every person in the household can have a bedroom, and there needs to be two more bedrooms available before we consider that house partitionable. So with the help of the census, so anyone that fails to fill in their census, which of course is a statutory requirement, but it's also really important for us to do this sort of modelling.
So you were able to find out how many people were living in what size houses. And also, Kay, this comes as we get the statistics just released about where our demographics are heading. And
that's
the
right.
Biggest growing demographic is two-person households, mainly empty nesters. That's the biggest growing demographic.
Absolutely.
For the next few years. So
yeah.
Perhaps people who've lived in a home and raised a family in it are now in it without a family.
Yeah.
So you got those raw numbers. And then what did you do?
And then we applied these rules. So we looked at the numbers in the household, we looked at the household composition, we looked at the number of bedrooms in a household. So we used bedrooms as a measure of the size of a dwelling. And then we just calculated for each region the number of homes that would be partitionable. And essentially what we were saying is that you really had to have a four-bedroom home before it starts being partitionable at all, because of the very conservative rules. We're being very generous in terms of our space.
You're talking about this as a realistic option, not just
yeah.
who we could pack in, if everyone
yeah.
was happy with that,
yeah.
but where is there a physical building that could be delineated so that you felt like you were in your home and someone else was in theirs.
And you can partition it off and you can have a kitchen and a bathroom put in and do all of those facilities. So you've got two or possibly more if it's a very big home, independent home. This is actually not new in New Zealand. If you think about all those great big houses that were built in the 1880s, right through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and again in the 50s and 60s, there was a lot of partitioning that went on those great big villas, double-storey villas, often into more than one or two units. And I bet most people in New Zealand have known someone that's lived in those. Some were done incredibly well. Some of those were done incredibly badly.
There are flats now, particularly in our student cities where this is the case. You're talking about a fresh opportunity. Absolutely. With demographic change and different, probably, and more modern homes.
And both more modern homes and some older homes, but yeah, essentially with good techniques is things like kitchen pods, bathroom pods now, which are coming out of the building industry, which could be used easily to help partition homes. But the main thing is that it gives us two opportunities. It gives those that need to downsize the opportunity to divide up their home without leaving their community. And that's a really important thing, particularly for older people.
So that's one part of it, is the partitioning. Shall we call it a reasonably sophisticated partitioning,
exactly,
of homes? Right. That's one part of it. The second part of it is putting units on existing land. And you point out this is already happening under the housing strains we're under.
Yeah.
People living in garages or people putting up temporary structures illicitly.
Yeah.
So when you are talking about additional units on properties, what are you talking about?
Well, what I'm talking about is an authorised dwelling, one that's fit for purpose, that meets the building standards and actually provides healthy, comfortable living environments. Might be a small unit. If you think about the movement for tiny homes, for instance, that's happened because it reduces the cost to individuals, might increase the per square metre cost, but the overall cost of the home is much smaller. But we've got nowhere to put those homes because of the way in which our ADU policies are actually very old. They need to be modernised and they need to recognise that we have a lot of land around our houses. And one of the things that we found with previous research and with older people and their downsizing desires is it often wasn't around them wanting to move to a different type of house or wanting to leave their community, was that they didn't want to have the burden of a very large section. They didn't want the burden of heaps of housework and the costs associated with that. And a lot of those people are also quite income poor, even though they're asset rich.
So when we're talking about ADUs, new units on sites, we are talking about properly constructed. We think of already of granny flats. Are they sort of similar?
Absolutely. Well, granny flat was an ADU. And that was, you know, it was a mushrooming, if you like, of granny flats in the 1970s, where the whole thing, and they were called granny flats because the idea was that you'd put granny into them and you would have a house. Times have changed. It's actually probably granny that's got the house. And so it's more likely, you know, you might want to swap between, you know, the secondary dwelling and the primary dwelling. But the reality is there's a lot of older people who have space to spare that could have a proper unit put on there. Indeed, for people, things like their own care, to have if they want live-in care, but they don't want that in the house, they can have that in an ADU. There's some American research which is very interesting where they've found where they've put generations together, not within a single house, but in an ADU and a primary house, then the relationship between older people and their children that they might be living with on a proximate site, on the same site, it maintains independence, it allows for mutual support, but it also means that they spend quality time together. So there's some good indications there's a win-win on this.
Does it have to be family members, by the way? Because what we're going to get to in a minute is the rules and subdividing and consents. And so with an ADU, could you have someone who is not a family member living on a unit in your site? Or at the moment, if you were going to do that, would you have to go through quite a serious process?
Well, it all depends which council area you're living in, and that's one of the problems. So there's ADUs which are related to employees, there's ADUs which are related to family members, there's some councils that allow ADUs for anyone you like. So there's a huge amount of variation that goes on here. The point about ADUs is, though, you don't need to subdivide. This can stay on the site. It can be taken off the site if you get a prefab that is just essentially craned in. You can also crane those out. There's some advantages in that. So you don't need to go through the subdivision thing. So what you're really trying to do here is to provide people who have a land asset is to actually to contribute that, if you like, to building up our housing infrastructure and diversifying
it. What would the legal situation be, though? Because you could see someone living on a property who's got spare land, thinks I can lease this out, to use the broad term, as they might lease out a bedroom. Mm-hmm. You can live there for a while, or you can live there permanently. Mm-hmm. What is the legal obligation between that landowner and the person who's unit they're in, or could you just lease out the land and put the unit on it? What are the options?
You can do mix and match. You can lease out the land and allow someone to build on that, and they own the house. And so if they left, they could take the dwelling unit with them, their tiny house with them. You could rent it out, in which case you'd be covered by the tenancy legislation. So it depends what you decide to do. The real problem is that we, I'm a homeowner, as many people of my age are, and young people are not. And the real problem is that my decisions are now constrained by where I live and a very complex set of provisions by councils. In some cases, councils don't have any provisions for ADUs. So that's the real problem.
Let's get into the rules in a moment. But first, there is a history. You mentioned the 1970s and the granny flat development. And these things are often driven by demographics, which is why this is an interesting one, with people literally downsizing.
Yeah.
Not only the 1970s, was it back in the 1930s that ADUs were a thing?
A lot of partitioning happened in the 1930s, and that was because we had a big stock. Those who are in Christchurch, they'll remember if you went along Papanui Road, there were great big villas there. Almost all of those over the 1930s and 40s became partitioned. And it wasn't just for students. These weren't student flats. These were often single people or a couple, and they were partitioned up. And you have similar things in Wellington, around the back of Oriental Bay. You'll find quite a number of older dwellings that have been partitioned up, in that case, to quite a high level of standard and price. So this is not a new thing in New Zealand, but we haven't given it attention in the last 40 years,
really. Are they effectively apartments? Those houses that have been and are actually on separate titles and owned by separate owners?
Some of them are. Some developers that might do partitioning might put them into unit titles and various things. So there's a wide variety of ownership things that can go on. But you can't even get to thinking about that until it's clear what you're trying to provide and what the council is going to allow you to do.
Let's get into the difficulties that you find when people come to want to do this on their property, because people hear two things. They hear consents and they hear dollar signs.
Yeah.
So what are the rules, the variety of rules that you believe are inhibiting this opportunity?
Well, I think it's the variety itself that's inhibiting the opportunity. So if you go into one jurisdiction, one council, you know, the ADU might be allowed to be 35 square metres, and another it might be 80 square metres, it might be 60 square metres. It might vary within a council according to zone, which is quite logical, and indeed you would expect that to happen. What you wouldn't expect is every council to have a completely different set of provisions and rules around ADUs. Some councils actually specify who can live in an ADU. So they'll say, you can have an ADU, but it only can be a family member. So there's all sorts of variety of stuff going on, and there's no logic to it. There's no coherence to it. There's no reason for it. It's just rollovers from old planning decisions of, 50 years past, really. And we need to modernise that, because if we modernise it, we can come up with really good ADU solutions and designs which can be bought in at a much lower cost for people.
Well,
so,
this is
of
the
course,
point.
There is money involved.
This is a prefabrication opportunity as well,
sure,
which
is.
Everyone is saying we can speed up building, but because these units are comparatively straightforward, I presume,
yes.
This can be sped up. The two things that occur to me that are in play, one is tenancy laws, if you're going to have people living on your property in something you own, but then the other is ownership. If you're going to allow someone to either lease your land or own your land or live temporarily on the property. So which laws are in play before we even get to council rules?
Well, actually, it's the council rules first, actually, because all of those decisions, what you decide to do in terms of tenure, comes after actually getting an ADU on. Councils don't say anything about what tenure it should be in. So those decisions are really dependent on whether you can get an ADU on there in the first place. So if you can't do that, you might as well not worry about whether you want to own it, lease it, rent it out, whatever, immaterial.
And what of the partitioning? Is that part of ADU rules or is it separate rules?
Well, it's a little bit unclear from district plans and part of the problem. And in fact, partitioning, I mean, most councils would say, oh, yes, we allow partitioning. But the rules are not clear about partitioning. There are only about four councils that are absolutely really specific about partitioning.
Is this often to do with bathrooms and kitchen facilities being available?
It's about bathrooms and kitchen facilities. It's about the relationship between the Resource Management Act on one hand and the building consent. You'll always have to get a building consent for an ADU because you're putting in a new bathroom, a new kitchen. You've got to have stormwater. You've got to have sewage. So you do have to do these things are not without cost.
Is the question that the cost gets too high and or it's seen too hard to go through the process to incentivise people? Is there something that could be universal for this kind of a purpose?
I think the building industry could come up with some really good solutions. That's the first thing. But they won't if there's huge inconsistency across the country because they can't get enough scale in there. That's the first thing. The second thing is I'm not sure that it's an issue about incentivising people to do it. I think it's about promoting the idea that people can think about doing that. So at the moment we do have partitioning, we still have people partitioning. They're usually developers, they're usually going around looking and seeing whether
way more people to do it. Want people now whose families have moved out to think about doing this. They're not builders, they're not developers, and they probably don't have a lot of money to throw around.
And
so is there a way we can make this simpler, cheaper, remove the barriers?
I think absolutely. I think the first thing is that we need a national policy around ADUs. We need a national policy around partitioning, and that needs to be led by central government, and it means all the councils need to come together. That's the very first thing, because unless you do that, everyone's in a terrible situation. I think the next thing is that we need to be thinking about how can we finance that, and if government is looking at 100,000 new homes, we're looking at greenfields, we're looking, putting huge amounts of investment about that. Perhaps we should be thinking about putting investments into this and finding ways in which we can finance and secure people's development and support people through that process.
There's something else that occurs to me, and I know it's further down the track, but it is the question of ownership. Right now you've got, where there is shared property, you've got cross leases, you've got unit titles, you've got company share, you've got freehold and stratum, on and on and on.
Yeah.
If people are thinking, all right, I'm prepared to either maybe put my big, huge house onto two titles and sell, because this is the other thing. If you're in Auckland or Wellington or many other cities and you're looking at an $800,000 mortgage and you're in your 20s or 30s, you're going, no.
But if
you can buy your first house legally, securely, for $300,000 to $400,000, you're in business.
Mm.
But do we also need to tackle that? If we're going to say, let's have more units of different kinds, do we need to, again, simplify and clarify those ownership systems?
We both need to simplify them in some ways, but we also need to diversify them. One of the things that the community housing sector is doing is that there's a lot of community housing providers that are looking at shared ownership. So the community housing provider has a stake in the house, but a person can buy into that. Unfortunately, that's made very difficult by the current interpretation of charities and the position of community housing providers under the Charities Act and the way charity services deal with them. So some of the big, Queenstown Lakes being an obvious example, who are providing shared ownership opportunities, the people that they're providing for are seen as too high an income. And yet they can't afford a house to be a worker in Queenstown.
But come back to that existing stock. How easy is it or not for someone just to say, I'm going to put this property on two titles and I'm going to sell half of it I don't need anymore?
It's a little bit tricky. And again, it will depend in part on the council itself and the zones that you're in. So all of that issue around ownership, what you can do with your house, how you can actually use it more effectively, not only for you but others, is something we need to really think about logically.
What's your conclusion? This is we may well be hearing quite soon an interview, actually, but we're going to be hearing in the next few days an interview about the constraints on the construction industry. Mm. Everybody says we need all these houses or all these properties now, and actually the reality is they're going to struggle to deliver.
Absolutely.
So if this is something that could happen, including the prefabrication elements, but if this is something that could happen in comparatively short time frames, what would get it moving? What would you do as a consequence of this report?
I think the first thing is that you'd immediately get a national statement about ADUs and sort out council rules around these, and you need to do that quite quickly. The second thing is that you really need to start thinking about good design, simple houses with consent so the prefab industry can actually meet that. We've got a number of factory housing builders in New Zealand which are underutilised. This is madness in our situation. So we do have a crisis of materials and supply and people, labour, but we also have, and there's a factory in Christchurch and elsewhere, which actually is not working up to its production limits. So if we could get a series of simple houses that are consented, which means they have national consent, so you don't have to go through building consent for every dwelling, they're pre-consented, we could actually start cooking with gas here.
Is this in the hands of government ministers, or will it be?
I think it's partly in the hands of government ministers. I think it's partly in the hands of councils, and that's part of the problem.
Your report,
to come together.
I mean.
Yeah. Oh, this is in the hands of the minister. Yes, he received it last night. But I think it's also in the hands of the building industry and we as householders thinking much more imaginatively about our housing.
Kay, thank you. Kay Saville-Smith, Director of CRESA, the Centre for Research Evaluation and Social Assessment. Where can people find this? Is it online somewhere?
It will be online. It will be on the Better Building Homes, Towns and Cities website.
We'll get a link up.
So, yeah, get a link up.
Thank you, Kay.